on Energy and Environment will come to order. We have a series of bills today, colleagues, followed by an informational meeting. I guess I wasn't that interested in the informational meeting, apparently. We'll start with opening a work session on committee measure introduction, per usual. Representative Boone.
Chair Bailey, I move that LC 3159, dated January 29, 2013, be introduced as a committee bill.
Vice Chair Boone moves that LC 3159, dated January 29, 2013, be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion? Any objection? Motion carries. And close the work session. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2440. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 2440 defines solar energy projects, provides the Department of Land Conservation and Development to work with the Oregon Department of Energy, Oregon Department of Agriculture, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to review laws relating to the siting of solar energy projects. Requires the LCD to report to appropriate legislative committees on or before September 1st, 2013. Declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Thank you. Before we begin, colleagues, I want to start by thanking Representative Boone for chairing the work group on solar siting in the interim, and I think getting us to a really good place on this discussion. This bill is a continuation of that discussion. We're going to do something a little bit out of the ordinary, colleagues, on this one. Beth Petrino, who was our committee administrator for the previous session, is going to give us some factual information to provide some continuity about the work group. But I want to note that she's been given special dispensation to come do this. This is not standard procedure for committee staff to come testify. So it is neutral factual information. Beth, actually, I'm going to have you sit right in the middle.
Right in the middle? Okay.
And I'm going to call up David Brown and Todd Cornett to flank you on the other side in case there's additional questions that they can answer that have a less neutral nature. Thank you. Please.
Less factual.
Yeah, less factual. Hopefully still factual.
I would like to dump, a lot of thanks on Beth for all her work.
Oh, you're that. Very welcome.
She did just a great job. And I think it was a really good meetings that I managed to get there. And the last one, which I managed to get there, when they left, they quit early and I got there late, so it was, I couldn't make it. But she did just a fabulous job of this. So, really thank her. She made me look good.
All right.
Which is hard to do. Thank you, Beth.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And so right before you begin, colleagues, you'll note that in your packet on the dais today, you have a list of the other members of the work group. It was a fairly extensive list. So with that, Beth.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Beth Petrino with the Committee Services Office. As Representative Bailey has indicated, I just wanted to give you some background on the work group itself. It was started up by the co-chairs of the interim committee, Reps Bailey and Gilliam. And as he noted, Representative Boone chaired the group, and there were representatives from a very broad spectrum of interest groups, as noted on the list that you've received. The group began meeting last summer, and after an initial meeting split into two subgroups, one to discuss the wildlife standard that is contained in the LCDC rules, and the second to address the statutory trigger that directs the project through either a local land use process or through the Energy Facility Siting Council process. Each subgroup met a couple times over the summer and fall, and the full work group held its last meeting on November 27th. They did reach a general agreement on revisions to the wildlife standard, which had been forwarded to the Chair of the Land Conservation and Development Commission by letter for consideration as a rule change. With respect to the jurisdictional trigger, the work group reached some consensus but did not ultimately agree on a fix to the current statutory inconsistency that exists. Todd Cornett, who's with the Siting Council, can give you a more detailed explanation of what that inconsistency is, but suffice it to say that in statute right now there are two triggers for when a solar project goes to FSEC for siting. So that's just a quick summary of what the work group did, and they were great to work with, and I enjoyed it, and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any questions for Ms. Petrino? Thank you for providing the continuity. We appreciate the
You're
help.
Welcome.
Mr. Cornett, would you like to begin, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Todd Cornett. I'm the Siting Division Administrator for the Oregon Department of Energy. I'm going to start with a handout. So, I don't know if I could hand it out really quick, because that's the right out of the gate that I'm going to be talking about. So on the first page of the handout that you're getting is a couple of photos of a concentrating solar thermal facility. On the second page is a solar photovoltaic facility. And I wanted to start with that because there's some pretty distinct differences between the two, and it'll make sense later on when we're talking about some of the jurisdictional thresholds. So the concentrating solar facility is a system that uses mirrors or lenses to concentrate a large area of sunlight or solar thermal energy onto a small area. The electrical power is produced when the concentrated solar light is converted to heat, which drives a heat engine, usually a steam turbine, and that's connected to an electrical power generator. The importance of this is that if you see on the photos, there's a kind of a steam generation facility associated with the acreage of the solar panels, and so it functions more like, at least that portion of it functions more like a natural gas facility. So, you know, there are employees there on a daily basis, so there's a lot more sort of post-construction activity at that kind of facility. The second page is the solar photovoltaic, which most people are probably used to, the large-scale solar panels, and this converts solar radiation. Once that's constructed, it's largely passive in nature. There's not a lot of activity at those facilities. So, as Beth talked about, there are two jurisdictional thresholds right now in the state definition of energy facilities, and on the third and fourth page, I provided that definition. The first is the 100-acre threshold, and this is listed in sub D, and I've highlighted the appropriate locations. So for 100 acres, that is in the range of about 10 to 20 megawatts, and that's for both concentrating solar and solar photovoltaics. This threshold was established in 1975. The next one, which is on the second page near the bottom, which is sub J, is the 105 megawatt threshold. It's actually listed in the definition as a 35 megawatt threshold, but that's the average electrical generating capacity. And so for both solar and wind energy, the estimate is that they work at about 30% capacity. And so the actual maximum or nameplate capacity of a facility would be 105 megawatts for that. And that's why it's referred to as the 105 megawatt threshold. So at that threshold, that would be equivalent to about a range of 525 to 1,050 acres. I think there's a lot of variation in specific locations about efficiency, so that's why there's such a wide variation. This threshold was originally established in 1991. It was originally a 25 megawatt threshold, and at that time that was established, there was no change to the 100-acre standard. This was changed in 2001 to the current 35 megawatt threshold, and again, there was no change in the 100-acre standard. And so that's what we have today, is two very distinct and different standards. So based on research, there's no legislative intent as to the meaning of either one. Some have felt that the 100-acre was intended to be for the thermal or the concentrating solar, whereas the 105 was for the solar PV. But there, again, there's no legislative intent. The language is unclear. And so what we have effectively is the lower threshold is the one that applies. And that lower threshold, as I said, at 10 to 20 megawatts is going to be the 100-acre threshold. So that is effectively what we have today. And so that's the background that we started that jurisdictional subgroup that Representative Boone chaired in trying to evaluate and come up with maybe some changes. So what we ended up with is, and I'm going to call it general consensus on many things. We didn't vote, so this is not necessarily the opinion of every single member, and I assume that some probably don't agree with this, but but generally I'll refer to what I think most people we got the head nod for. The first was that the solar thermal and the solar photovoltaic should be different thresholds. Because of that differentiation in the post kind of construction operational activities, those should be in different locations. The initial thought was because it functions like a gas plant, that on your definitions, on the first page, which is page 3 of the handout, in sub A, it talks about thermal power. That might be a good location for it. That has a 25 megawatt threshold. There may be other opportunities, but that's kind of where we looked at initially. So there was general agreement on kind of that breakup between those two types of facilities. The second was that an acreage threshold was an appropriate threshold for the solar PV. It's really the impact is when it's sited. It's a footprint impact. Again, after the fact, it's fairly passive, and so it's really that initial footprint kind of acreage impact, and so an acreage is appropriate. There was consensus that there should be a variation in kind of the specifics on the ground. What we focused in on was agriculture and agricultural productivity, and so that there should be variations based upon the agricultural productivity of the land, and that's what we kind of ended up with. And so for high value and arable lands, we again had a general consensus that that should be a 100-acre threshold. And again, next we had consensus on kind of the non-arable threshold should be an acreage based upon how land is utilized where most of these utility scale solar facilities would be, which would be in Eastern Oregon. And typically land is very large scale. It's broken, usually broken up and utilized in sections. So, you know, section is 640 acres or a mile by a mile. And so we looked at that kind of acreage to being that larger threshold. And so the last straw man that was proposed at the sub-jurisdictional group or the jurisdictional group was that it be a 320-acre threshold or a half a section. And some of the members were in agreement or consensus on that, and I think primarily industry was not. What they felt was that the minimum should be 640 acres or a full section of land. And so that's really where we ended up with was that kind of we didn't have consensus on what that acreage threshold should be. But then the final thing that we did have consensus on was we felt it was the right group of people that were in the room. We, you know, you have the list. We thought everybody was working well together, and should there be no legislation that made that fix during the session, that we were in agreement that we should continue working on this issue to make sure that that issue was, that there was overall consensus by the time we got to the next legislative session, so we would have something ready to propose to the legislature where everybody could be on board with. And so that's really where we ended up at. Great. So with that, I would entertain any questions.
Questions? Thank you for that summary, and thank you for your willingness to work on this. My understanding is there was a lot of progress that was made, although some, as you say, unresolved issues, but that there was significant progress made. So appreciate you engaging in these discussions in good faith. Mr. Brown?
Thank you, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. My name is David Brown. I'm the senior principal of Obsidian Renewables, and I'm a larger scale solar developer in what I playfully call the sunny part of the state. I was very pleased to serve on the committee, and I echo everything that's been said about the committee's work. Absolutely endorse Chair Bailey's observation that Representative Boone was quite effective, even though she stayed a little bit behind the scenes. And we had great help from all of the administrators and state staff that was assigned to the committee. I thought people listened and were very respectful of each other's points of view, and I thought we made a lot of progress. From my perspective, as we got to the question of when should FSEC jurisdiction step in? The larger questions from most of the people in the room was, what is it that we're trying to protect? What's the problem that we want FSEC to be focused on? And there was some very interesting discussion from Fish and Wildlife that it's not really so much about size as it is about impact. That if you're located in the wrong place, it's the wrong place, whether you're 100 acres or 1,000 acres. But if you're located in the right place, it's the right place, whether it's 100 acres or 1,000 acres. The example that resonated with me was don't build in front of a bat cave no matter what size you are. So we didn't really get to that level of understanding on the committee, and that those are interesting concepts, but those are not easy concepts for a group to just put together. So I felt like the size limitation was kind of a proxy for what really is a bigger set of analysis. I've been consistently persuaded by Representative Bent's view that we don't know what small is when it comes to Eastern Oregon. And most of my property is in Eastern Oregon, and of course I understand that. The sensitivity about the arable lands and the high-value farmlands is really sensitivity about the Willamette Valley, and I understand that. So I think there was consensus around all these points, but I thought 320 acres was kind of an awkward compromise that really wasn't based in science or need, more just, well, we have to compromise, so let's compromise. So the report is correct that some of us held out for 640 acres, which is approximately 100 megawatts at today's technology. But as Mr. Cornett reported, there's a lot of variability in the technology, and that might be 70 megawatts or it might be 100 megawatts, depending on layout and whatnot. So, but this is something that I would very much like to see get resolved. I am very happy to report that I think that bigger solar projects can be done here in Oregon, and this confusion about this rule is an impediment, and so it would be good to get it resolved. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Question. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave, I want to thank you for coming out to Ontario and looking at some of the space we have out there. You got to see a mere fraction of the 6 million acres available in just Malheur County, but nonetheless you came out, and we appreciated that. It would have been good if I'd been planning ahead to have the Google overhead that we looked at as we zoomed in on your facility in Christmas Valley, because it's extraordinarily enlightening. I wish we could do it right now, in fact, for the group. As you come into Christmas Valley and see what's the size of that, one there?
60 acres.
60 acres. And it's in the area where there used to be pivots, but because of the high alkaline content of the ground, they've been long since been abandoned. They're far greater size than your 60-acre parcel. And as you zoom in, you are given a sense of the sheer size of that area, which is a fraction of the size of just Malheur County, a modest fraction. And so this is an extremely important issue to my district and to all of Eastern Oregon. And again, just to refresh everyone's memory, my district is 19 million acres, 29,000 square miles. So 320 acres out of 19 million is a pretty modest number. And so to say that Fish and Wildlife would find anything of value in the area that the 70 acres would be a real challenge. Mr. Chair, I'm so happy you brought this back, and I do hope that we can do some additional work and move toward a standard that better utilizes the vast space we have out there that's really built for this type of use.
Further questions or a response?
Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, thank you, and I once again, sir, I completely agree with you. Thank you.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, and I guess this is the first I've heard about the work of this committee. I think it's a great undertaking, but I would just hope that we could have future conversations in this chamber about how we could utilize Oregon's land resources to put people back to work, to generate some economic growth, perhaps site some residential housing and other commercial opportunities here and there, because we have a lot of developable land, and as long as it works with our friends and within the agencies, I think we ought to have that conversation. So I applaud the committee. Thank you.
And to your point, Vice Chair Johnson, this bill, should it come out of this committee, will be headed to the Land Use Committee next for its consideration along those issues. I do have a question. Mr. Brown, when you're looking at that section size at 640 acres, you had expressed some perhaps concern that the group might be working at finding a compromise that was based more on compromise than perhaps on any scientific reason. Is there, do you have a particular reason why 640 is more of the sweet spot? Is that, or in your opinion, is that also just sort of a best guess?
Chair Bailey, that's a very fair question. I can't identify any reason based in science why you would say 640 and not 1,000, or frankly why you'd say 640 and not 320. To me, it's it's a question of whether or not you're disturbing something that you shouldn't disturb. It's extremely common for someone to, in that area in Christmas Valley, for someone to raise hay on 6,000 or 7,000 acres. I mean, there's nothing magic about a section. But in eastern Oregon and central Oregon, land is often referred to in sections. It's often purchased as sections. It's a natural size. 1,000 acres would be not a natural size on the maps, or to be divided. Often to get 1,000 acres, you'd have to do a partition. But I can't give you any reason in science, no.
So if I may summarize your point, feel free to tell me if I'm wrong. It sounds like what you're saying is that in the absence of better information to the contrary, that 640 seems to be more of the default size.
Well, it is approximately what the current law is in my view. In my view, sure. It's 105 megawatts, so it's a little smaller than the current law, but it approximately fits it. That was the other reason.
Good. Further questions for this panel? Okay, thank you all very much. I'd like to call up Michael Morrissey and Joe Esmond. Morrissey, why don't you begin?
Well, Chair Bailey and Committee, I'm Michael Morrissey, and I'm a policy staff from the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I participated in the work group that was just referenced. I personally participated on the threshold group, subgroup, and another staff member participated in the Fish and Wildlife. I wasn't asked to present any prepared remarks, so I don't have anything particularly to say other than I feel like our department participated in good faith and we understand the issues and we also want to get to a good resolution.
Any particular comments on the issue of the jurisdictional?
So we're Bailey and committee, less so perhaps than the Fish and Wildlife, since our rules addressed Fish and Wildlife issues, and so I think the commission and certainly the staff will be happy to hopefully put that to bed. The jurisdictional issue isn't exactly our issue, and it doesn't modify our statutes. I'll say that I think really the issue that it addresses is who's going to handle an application. Will it be FSEC? Will it be a county? And I think we'll just have to see how that plays out. I wish that there were more historical record of FSEC having handled a permit for solar. There isn't so far, so we don't really have anything to compare to. But at any rate, whether it's the county or whether it's FSEC, they apply the rules and the statutes that the legislature has put in place and the rules that the department puts in place. So after that, it's just a matter of time. I think our group discussed, generally speaking, for a permit, the decision has to be reached on a complete permit in 180 days by a county, and by FSEC, it may be longer than a year. But that's where the fulcrum is, and other than that, it's not really our issue as clearly as the others were.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Esmond.
Excuse me, sorry.
Representative Reed.
We still have some new members on the committee, so we need a little acronym definitions occasionally. So,
sorry.
FSEC?
Energy Facility Siting Council, which is administered through the Department of Energy, and there's no, doesn't implicate any of our department's rules or regulations directly.
Good question. Mr. Esmond.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Joe Esmond. I represent the IBW Local 48.
Portland, Oregon. My job is politics and the green stuff. I was part of the work group last year, and I want to thank Ms. Petrino for trying to herd the cats. It's she did a very good job. That being said, I want to remind the committee and anybody listening that there are two manufacturing plants in the state of Oregon that are hurting. One up in Portland, Hillsboro area, and one down here in Salem. There's an inverter company over in Bend that could use the work. So my frustration would be SolarWorld has just laid off a third of their people. Let's put these people to work. This, some of these projects are great. 180 days, 1 year to do this is, to me, even though I work down here a lot, seems kind of excessive. There are other states that have gone through this process. Maybe this state could learn how to do some streamlining to make these jobs, these things feasible. My union, out of their own pockets, have trained 2,000 people, over 2,000, in solar. If I have 15 working today, I'd be surprised. So it isn't just about the union jobs, construction jobs, which are temporary jobs, some people say. There's some I'm here for the businesses, too. So let's help these people out. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you both very much. I appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who would like to be heard on this bill today? Seeing none, colleagues, I would tell you that it is my intention to find a statutory solution to the issues that we've heard today. To that end, we are actually in the process of drafting an amendment based on where the committee landed. We will be sharing that with the committee and looping back with some of the stakeholders who are part of that group. And it's my hope that we will have something that we can move on to the next committee relatively quickly in over, I would say, the next week or two. So lots to come on this, and this will be an issue that we'll be engaging on. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2440 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2439. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee. House Bill 2439 transfers duties, functions, and powers of the Oregon Department of Energy contained within ORS 496A.005 to ORS 469A.210 to the Public Utility Commission. These ORS statutes deal with the Renewable Portfolio Standard and the Renewable Energy Certificate System. It provides direction to ODO and the PUC regarding records, properties, employees, revenues, rules, liabilities, and obligations during and after the transfer. It becomes operative on January 1st, 2014. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Thank you. I'd like to call up Scott Bolton and Brenda McCarthy, please. Bolton, why don't you kick us off?
Good afternoon, Chair Bailey, committee members, Scott Bolton on behalf of Pacific Corp. House Bill 2439 is simply part of a theme that Pacific Corp and PG communicated last year as part of the discussion around the governor's energy plan. And that the idea is that the state should, where it can and where it makes sense, remove barriers or streamline regulations around allowing businesses to help meet the state's energy goals. Both of our companies supported passage in 2007 of Senate Bill 838, which is the Oregon Renewable Energy Act. And really, we see this bill as an opportunity for the legislature to do a check-in to see how major policies being implemented by the state are being implemented by the state's agencies. Our experience over the last 4 to 5 years with the Department of Energy in trying to implement elements of Senate Bill 838, and in particular, the regulation of qualifying renewable facilities has been frustrating. And, you know, we bring this bill simply because we have experienced those problems in the past. Just to give you a few examples, the department has established a three-year certification process for these resources. Every 3 years, we have to fill out paperwork and re-certify that wind turbines, solar panels, the resources that we have in our portfolio that customers are paying for in our rates are still Oregon compliant with the standard. We're not sure we understand why or how that certification process grew up, but you know, we did have a situation last year where 9 wind facilities, the recertification was being held up and not processed in a timely way, bringing some uncertainty of whether the state was still going to recognize the production of these facilities or not. Another example is, as this committee knows, some members of the committee from last session, it's taken over 3 years to get resolution to the treatment of hydro efficiency upgrades. The Oregon Renewable Energy Act recognizes these investments as a qualifying renewable resource. However, working with the department and trying to get to some conclusion to how to measure and account for these upgrades was incredibly frustrating and often hallmarked with very little transparency in how the department was establishing its position and in process. And then probably another example, and I'll leave it there, has been the department's intervention at the Public Utility Commission in our compliance docket. So we are now in the position of annually complying with Oregon's Renewable Energy Act. We provide a report to the PUC. The PUC oversees that report and determines if indeed we have generated enough qualifying renewable energy to meet Oregon's standard. The department staff came in during this this compliance period and raised new issues and questions that frankly would have unwound what we felt was long settled interpretation of the act, as well as brought real uncertainty over our future ability to comply. Thankfully, the PUC didn't really go along with this, but what we've seen historically at least is a pattern of the department creating some barriers for our ability to comply with the state's renewable goals. Now, I want to be really clear that we think that there's a change. You know, I want to give Ms. Schwartz, the director of the department, all the credit in the world for finding a final resolution to this hydro upgrade issue. I think that's important to note. And we do think that the department is committed to improving its engagement in customer service. And so I want to make that very clear. But this experience gives us an opportunity to simply ask the question, is the Department of Energy the right agency to be performing this work? When you consider that compliance is overseen by the Public Utility Commission, we file RPS, a Renewable Implementation Plan, with the PUC. So here's how we're going to meet the RPS. And then we annually go in and have the PUC oversee our compliance. Aligning all of the administration of the Renewable Energy Act under one agency makes a lot of sense. And frankly, the issues, the problems that we've had in this past with the department, I cannot imagine having come about in the same way at the PUC. PUC has very robust, transparent processes around establishing records for how they make decisions. That's something we really respect and, frankly, protects not only costs to customers, but also balances the integrity of the investments that we've made. So really, this legislation is before you as simply an opportunity to tee up the discussion of, is this the right venue for this work? Is the department, you know, committed to improving some of these processes? And is the act, frankly, being implemented in a way that's consistent with what the state set out in 2007? Thank you.
Thank you.
McCarthy. Thank you, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. Brendan McCarthy, representing Portland General Electric today. As you heard the other day, PGE is an investor-owned utility serving 825,000 customers in the Northern Willamette Valley. We are one of the three utilities that does have a compliance obligation under the Oregon RPS, and we are, as Mr. Bolton said, currently in the compliance period, have complied with our requirement for 5%. We're actually somewhere north of that, somewhere around 11% renewables right now, and are banking those RECs for future compliance. So the I echo many of the things that Mr. Bolton said, starting off with we are pleased with the direction the department is heading at this point. We believe the communication has improved dramatically. We believe that there has been much greater attention by staff to issues that had long simmered on this topic. But the bill here was put in, I believe, at a time when some of those issues were not settled. I think the next question that someone would ask is, does that mean the bill is not necessary? And I would say, well, I'm not quite sure that's the case either. As Mr. Bolton mentioned, there is a streamlining component to this. There were three pieces of authority given to the Department of Energy in the RPS. One was to determine the national low-impact hydro certifying organization. That has been done. Another is an ongoing obligation to determine whether there are other types of energy that are of the nature and kind found in the Renewable Act that could also comply. That has, to my knowledge, not actually been exercised yet. And the third was to decide on the existing system for renewable energy credit tracking, and that has been done. It has been determined to be REGIS, which is a Western States, a WEC-wide organization that tracks RECs, the sale and purchase and transfer of RECs. The one possible conflict, and you heard this from Director Schwartz the other day, is can there be more than one Regis administrator in the state, and whether this bill raises a question as to whether there would be two. We don't see that as a particularly difficult problem if it is raised. We certainly think that between the PUC and the Department of Energy, they can work out any details that need to be done on that. I have read the Regis rules. I don't see a rule, a specific rule in Regis that says there can only be one administrator. I take the department at their word that that's what Regis staff says, but I think it's something that could be worked through. If it's a matter of the PUC telling the staff person at ODO to certify a facility as Oregon eligible, that's acceptable. But as long as the PUC is making that determination, I think we feel a lot more confident with our economic regulator doing that. We believe certainly that it would be more likely that we would not run into the problems we ran into over the past few years in certifying those facilities as Oregon eligible. I think that concludes my testimony, and I'm available for questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Whitson.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to understand, are the decisions that you're asking the PUC now to make, would you have an appeal process if the PUC makes those decisions versus the Energy Department? How would you handle this?
Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, that's actually a really great question about process and transparency. That generally at the PUC, if they're establishing a new policy, if there's a formal proceeding, there will be an order by the PUC, and then there will be a process to reconsider that order and possibly appeal that order if there's a continued dispute. It's really unclear with the Department of Energy through their processes how to appeal other than going to the director and saying, we don't agree with what you've done. I think, probably the courts still offer some remedy, but it's not as clear, it's not as defined of a legal and regulatory process.
Chair Bailey and Representative Whitsitt to add on to that. The converse example of the Department of Energy that I can think of is that at some point in time during the past couple of years, the exact date escapes me, staff issued what they termed to be a guidance document on how to file for a hydroelectric efficiency upgrade. And this guidance document contained actual substantive requirements in it. How that guidance document was developed was unclear. It was not developed in a full public process. It was issued, and then there was an opportunity for comment, but the stake had already been put in the ground. So when, you know, and my objection to that was, there are substantive requirements in that guidance document. That's actually a rule. And if you want to adopt a rule, that's fine. Go through a rulemaking. But you're putting a utility that has a compliance obligation in a position where they're forced to choose between complying with a guidance document from an agency or not. And that's not a place that a compliance entity wants to be in. And that's difficult. If that had happened at the PUC, I'm fairly certain it would have been an open process where stakeholders would have been consulted ahead of time.
Thank you.
No questions. Representative Boone.
And maybe both of you could address it if you want. The PUC already is your main oversight. Was it an oversight of the RPS process to have that department be just for that piece, kind of like our bill going to that other committee instead of staying here?
Chair Bailey, Representative Boone. The actual statute is silent on the ongoing regulation of facilities. Having been involved in the crafting of Senate Bill 838 in 2007, stakeholders really didn't contemplate, I think, very deeply how exactly this administration would occur. At that point, even the Regis system had not yet gone live. It was still theoretic. We all knew that there would be this Western-wide accounting system available, and I think everybody, you know, pushed towards that as being the official accounting system. And so there is specific language in the statute saying the department will pick an accounting system, and that was, you know, presumed to be Regis. There's no language in the statute, nor is there really much of a legislative record around, well, once that system's been picked, here is who within state of Oregon government will interface with that system between those who invest in renewable energy generation facilities and the actual accounting system that will track the RECs that are produced from those. So this, you know, bureaucracy and process has kind of grown up around that more in silence than by specific authorization or direction.
Other questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate it. I'd like to call up Danelle Romaine, Beth Vargas Duncan, and Ted Case, please. Whoever would like to go first.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Danelle Romaine, and I'm here representing the Oregon People's Utility Districts Association. You heard from our representative, Barbara Trout, on Tuesday, so I think you know a little bit about PUDs. We have five PUDs in the state of Oregon, and we're just here to say that we understand the genesis of this bill. We had similar frustrations with hydro efficiency upgrades at the department. We believe those issues have been taken care of with Lisa Schwartz coming on at the department. We've had excellent meetings with Lisa over the past few months. She's done a ton in the very short time period that she's been there. We have a lot of faith in changes at the department moving forward on this issue and other issues, and are here to support the department and our work on the RPS. So that's basically our message. And if this bill does move forward, we would seek an alternate path for consumer-owned utilities, for PUDs, because basically our local boards, as Barbara discussed on Tuesday, are our PUC. They are our regulating body. So that's why we are not affiliated with the PUC.
Thank you. Mr. Case. Ms. Duncan.
Thank you, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. I'm Beth Vargas Duncan with Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities. And as you heard earlier in the week, we are 11 not-for-profit municipal utilities. And as Danelle already mentioned, we are governed by our governing boards, who are either appointed by their mayor or other elected officials, or they are the elected officials in the city. So we oppose House Bill 2439 and request that it remain at the Department of the Department of Energy, as Lisa Schwartz has made tremendous changes in the short time that she's been there. I do agree that there were problems and issues before. We don't dispute that, but we don't believe that it now is the time to change and split the program and have part one place and part another. For us, we do not come under the PUC for compliance. It's our own governing boards. If you have any questions?
Mr. Case.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, Ted Case, Executive Director of the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association, 18 electric co-ops in Oregon. You saw our map the other day, so you know that we represent some of the most rural and remote parts of the state. I think it's pretty much been said. We have some concerns with this legislation. We think that the PUC is probably not the right alignment for us. We're not regulated by the PUC. We don't spend as much time over there, certainly, as the investor-owned utilities. The consumer protection function of the PUC is for the investor in utilities, not for consumer-owned utilities. Having said that, I'm not going to minimize the frustrations that we heard from the previous panel or from my colleagues up here. Our RPS compliance function is not as rigorous right now as the IOUs, but what we have experienced at ODO has been very frustrating, frankly unacceptable. But we do see some success going on there right now. And again, Ms. Schwartz, I think, is should be commended for her work. So we're hopeful. We're watching the progress going on there. But right now, we're concerned about where this legislation goes.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Boone.
Well, maybe it's not even a question, but just a comment at this point. It's sounding like to me this is another one size doesn't fit all. And maybe what we should do if we're going to consider going forward is to split it and have the investor-owned utilities go with the PUC and then the publicly owned go with their the department.
Other questions or comments? Okay. Thank you all very much. Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on House Bill 2439 today? And I'll put your hands up at once. All right. That will close the public hearing on House Bill 2439 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2274. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 2274 prohibits the Environmental Quality Commission from adopting rules requiring reporting of greenhouse gas emissions other than actual greenhouse gas emissions produced by a generating facility.
And a familiar panel, Mr. Bolton, Mr. McCarthy. Mix it up a little bit.
All right. Hello again. Chair Bailey.
This is like a whole new panel.
Scott Bolton on behalf of Pacific Corp. House Bill 2274 is actually a fairly simple solution to a fairly complex problem. We call it the Truth in Greenhouse Gas Reporting Bill. And really, the reason this legislation is before you today is out of the uncertainty created over the treatment of what's called null power. And if you'll indulge me for a second, null power is essentially power that's produced from an otherwise renewable energy facility, but does not have the renewable energy certificate associated with it. So consider it almost an unbundled product. A classic example of how null power is created is the federal law that requires utilities to purchase small renewable power generation. This federal law has been in place since 1978, and utilities are obligated to purchase the output of these facilities. Usually they're small hydro, sometimes they're wind, sometimes they can even be biopower. Oregon policy is that the renewable energy certificates or credits associated with this power should be retained by the generator. So even though federal law says we have to purchase the power, the generator gets to keep the renewable attribute or REC. What this does is it creates kind of a no man's land, this gray piece of the pie chart that has basically been labeled null power. So null power on its face isn't so much of a problem because you know, we are fine with the idea of disclosing that this is power that we don't own the renewable attributes to. We don't claim this power towards our renewable portfolio standard obligations. You know, for disclosure purposes, it hasn't become much of an issue. What has become an issue is the greenhouse gas emissions treatment of this power. For us, and we think common sense would say that this power comes from a generator that did not create greenhouse gas emissions. So even though we're not calling it necessarily green power or renewable for purposes of renewable portfolio standard compliance or even marketing to customers that they're receiving a green product, for emissions purposes, we think this should be zero. But what has come up through the course as a question, both at the PUC around power labeling, how we represent our fuel supply mix to our customers, as well as through DEQ's greenhouse gas reporting protocol, should this power have emissions associated with it or not? Some folks have come in and said, yes, if you don't have that renewable certificate, then that power cannot be zero emission. It has to be something. Therefore, almost creating a phantom emissions value for null power. As I'm sure you can appreciate, this puts a utility in an awful position where federal law requires us to purchase this power. State policy is that we don't receive the renewable attribute alongside that power, and yet we can see, theoretically, our carbon risk increasing. We could see more greenhouse gas being assigned to our system than what we know is actually produced by the generation entering our system. So consider for a moment a world where we have some kind of carbon regulation regime. We have greenhouse gas regulation where it's either a carbon cap and trade program or a carbon tax. Having good accounting of what the actual emissions are within your portfolio is crucial because that will be what the liability will be for that reporting entity. This is an issue that continues to get kicked down the road. When the issue has come up at the Public Utility Commission, you know, I think the decision has been we're not ready to make a decision on whether to assign emissions to null power or not. When this initially came up under Senate Bill 38 in the 2009 session, which established Oregon's mandatory greenhouse gas reporting program, DEQ, I think, wisely chose not to assign emissions to null power. But this is unsettled policy. And if the legislature at some point doesn't weigh in and establish how do we treat this situation, somebody else in state government will. And so that's really the genesis of this bill, is to provide an opportunity to have this discussion and have policymakers set a direction on how this should be done. Thank you.
Thank you.
Members of the committee, Chair Bailey, Brendan McCarthy representing PG again. Thank you for being willing to listen to my voice again. I want to be just to follow a few points. Mr. Bold keeps stealing my best lines. We want to be clear that this is about emissions and not renewables, and to separate the two. We're concerned, again, about that day that Mr. Bolton mentioned where there is a carbon regulatory regime, that if carbon is imputed to what is otherwise emissions-free resources, that that our customers will end up paying for emissions that occur elsewhere, which seems to be a bit of an absurd result. Finally, I think this is really about being honest and straightforward with customers about the generation sources. When we look at our generation pie, as I said earlier, we have 11% renewables. Now, for the renewable standard, we're only reporting 5% of those renewables because that's our requirement, and we are banking our renewable energy credits for future compliance. That does cause some confusion. We've come down the line of saying we should be reporting to our customers what our generation mix is, and not necessarily what electrons go into their socket, but what their generation mix is. I think when you start imputing carbon to this slice of null power, that gets really confusing. Imagine a utility that's 100% wind power. It's not really theoretically possible, but just imagine it just for a second. No, we have some way to integrate all of that variable power. Then there's another utility somewhere, some other state that's 100% coal power. And PGE, say it's the 100% wind power utility, sells all of its RECs, or 95% of its RECs, to this other utility in California so they can comply with their renewable standard. Imputing carbon to a 100% wind portfolio, in that case, I think you would see would be a very absurd result. And that's essentially what we're talking about here, but on a smaller fraction. It's saying, but wait a minute, I mean, our customers in that case would say, wait a minute, I thought PG was 100% wind. I mean, what are those wind turbines? How does that work? So I think it's really about truth and honesty in our labeling, and to do that otherwise, I think just raises a lot of unusual questions and odd results. Thanks.
I thought you were going to say sell it to PacifiCorp, and I was going to wait for awkwardness on the panel here.
For the record, we're not 100% coal utility. No.
We saw your helpful slides. We know that from last time around. Questions for this panel?
I was wondering how many megawatts or how much power do you estimate would fall under this bill right now that you are not getting the credit for?
Representative Bailey, Representative Woods, that's a really good question. I don't have that information off the top of my head. We will follow up with you. I will say, you know, the types of projects I described, these small, what they call qualifying facilities under the federal PURPA law, generally are a few megawatts in size, especially the smaller hydro. We're talking about hydro and irrigation districts, small community wind, generally not much larger than 10 megawatts, but our service territory in particular, because of its rural flavor, has a number of these. Mm-hmm. And I'll get you that number.
Thank you.
Representative Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, PGE has many fewer PURPA facilities. I'm thinking of one wind facility and a few other small projects. But your question raises another issue, which is under the renewable standard, we are allowed to bank our RECs indefinitely for future compliance. If we look out into the future and see that we don't need those RECs for future compliance, it may behoove us to sell those RECs to another utility in California, for example, that would be a benefit to our customers. We would want that opportunity to sell those RECs, and would not want to be in a position of trying to figure out whether there was a future where we might have to pay for doing so with a carbon cost. So I can't give you a number to that, but it's certainly we do sell RECs occasionally, or think about it anyway.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If for some reason we were to not fix this problem, would we see power rates go up to consumers with you having to implement more renewable energy?
Representative Widener, I guess the theoretically, the answer could be yes in different ways. I would say under the RPS construct, probably not, because we're not counting, nor are we trying to count these resources towards compliance. So it's not part of whether we meet the RPS standard or not. But to the extent that we are creating phantom emissions and adding to our emission total beyond what is actually being created within our portfolio, then yes, if there is a carbon tax or there is a regulatory regime that would make us decrease from that baseline. So yeah, I think that there is definitely a consumer protection component to this issue.
Okay, thank you both very much. I appreciate it. Call up Angus Duncan and Palmer Mason. Mr. Duncan. Thank you for making the drive down.
Chair Bailey and members of the committee. My name is Angus Duncan. I'm president of the Bonneville Environmental Foundation, and I chair the State of Oregon's Global Warming Commission. I'm here to speak on House Bill 2274, but I need to condition that this is not a bill that my commission has had a chance to look at. We don't turn on quite that small a dime, unfortunately. In fact, we don't have a dime to turn on.
Well played, sir.
No, I'm sorry. So my remarks here reflect my own views of what's needed to carry out the Commission's adopted Roadmap to 2020 recommendations. And my advice on this bill, I think, is to encourage you to proceed no further with it, certainly not as it's written. It may have virtues that are distinguishable to a keener eye than mine, but it also has some, at least to my reading, significant flaws. It is pointed entirely in the wrong direction. It's pointed in the direction of less information on carbon emissions, and therefore less well-informed choices than we need in both the public and the private sector. And if this is a solution to the null power problem, then it is a disproportionate solution, and that's the kindest way I can put it. And I'll come back to the null power issue, I guess, in a minute. The bill, as it is currently written, and as I read it, would all but end the gathering of bottom-up carbon data on carbon content, energy, and other uses in the state. We historically have had to develop top-down estimates of carbon consequences of different choices, and those are notoriously approximate estimates. So bottom-up reporting of carbon reductions is important for both the public sector and the private sector. I think we would all agree that cost-benefit analysis is an important part of decision-making, and in many of the actions that we are facing in both sectors, we'll know the cost, but if we don't know the carbon consequences, it's hard to be able to calculate relative benefits. These kinds of reliable data are needed not just in public policy, but they are needed to inform private sector investments as well. Having accurate greenhouse gas consequences data was a source of great frustration to the stakeholder group that worked with ODOT over the last 3 years to develop a state greenhouse gas transportation policy. It was a frustration to those of us who were involved with the governor's office in trying to develop a 10-year action plan and be able to describe the consequences of the choices that were being recommended. But it's also a problem in the private sector. My foundation, which is also a nonprofit business, is working with a Fortune 50 company to acquire carbon reductions all over the country. One set of reductions is potentially with Portland State University, and it has to do with boiler replacement. But if we can't calculate the carbon consequence of making that boiler replacement and track, you know, that consequence back up the supply chain, then my Fortune 50 company is not going to invest in supporting that boiler changeout, because we won't be able to tell them with assurance how many tons of carbon they are getting by way of reduction for the dollars that they're investing in that. And this is actually a fairly good-sized exercise. This is about a $40 million investment where my foundation is acting as the buyer's agent. And we have to be very careful about doing our due diligence. So we need these kinds, the kinds of data that this bill would seem to eliminate for any carbon consequences other than those associated specifically with a electric generation plant. The null power issue is an issue that, again, we have dealt with in the private sector on the in our business activities for at least 10 or 12 years, ever since we got involved in the REX trade and carbon reduction trade, and we engage in that all over the country. There are ways to deal with null power. The easiest way is simply to impute a carbon value to that null power, and this is something that the Oregon PUC could certainly do under an open proceeding that the utilities can be involved in. It's a much easier and more direct way to deal with assigning a carbon content to null power than the apparent elimination of all carbon reporting other than just from generating plants. So I would urge you to let this bill die a death in committee, and if the issue of null power is worth attending to, that you ask the Oregon PUC to address that first before the committee goes after the DEQ reporting requirements. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Mason.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm the Government Relations Manager for the Department of Environmental Quality. I'm here to comment today on House Bill 2274, a bill that would appear to reduce the information about greenhouse gas emissions from electricity. I'm not going to talk a lot about the background of the greenhouse gas reporting rules other than to reiterate they're important in terms of capturing the emissions out there associated with power and fuel. And that's important for us to track our progress towards the statutory goals that we have relating to greenhouse gas reductions. And I am by no means the expert on electricity, energy, power, or anything like that, but I do want to reiterate one point that Mr. Duncan made about taking a bottom-up approach. Formerly, we used to, as he indicated, model and estimate how much we had in the way of emissions, and the approach that we now use under the greenhouse gas supporting rules is one that is indeed more bottom-up oriented, where there's more of an effort to actually calculate the data in a more accurate way, and that's certainly critical for the public sector and the private sector. So it's an important approach, and I did want to emphasize that. I think our two concerns with this bill may be certainly the null power issue, but also another issue, and I'll start with that other issue first. The way we're reading the bill, it appears to us, and I did get a chance to briefly talk to the utilities before this committee meeting, so I had a chance to understand a little bit better that their intent is really around the null power issue. But that said, the way we read the bill, in that it appears to limit the counting of emissions from the generating facility, that would have the effect of not counting the greenhouse gas emissions that would come from the production of power out of state, where that power is purchased for use here in Oregon, where the demand is created. We wouldn't be counting those emissions. And that, if that's indeed the way the bill is written, then we're going to grossly undercount the actual emissions associated with the consumption of power, or specifically electricity, here in the state of Oregon. And again, I think that would be a concern if we're trying to keep an accurate count of emissions and making progress towards our goals. The other issue is, again, reading the bill the way we do, it by having a provision in there that we only count the actual emissions that come from the generating facility, we may lose the emissions associated with the use of transmission facilities to carry electricity. There is a chemical that's produced off of transformers. It's sulfur hexachloride, or fluoride, excuse me, sulfur hexafluoride, and that actually is a more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And while that's a small portion of the actual emissions that we see, again, it's a more potent gas. So if we're reading this bill to only count the emissions that come from the generating facility, then we may not be counting those particular emissions, and that would be another concern that we would have. And then on the null power issue, I certainly understand what the issue that utilities are raising, in that we're talking about the power that's generated by quote-unquote renewable sources and green sources. And I appreciate the suggestion that Mr. Duncan made. Maybe there's probably a better way to try to address that issue than simply writing it out of the process. And if there is an interest in going forward in that way, the Department of Environmental Quality certainly would want to be involved. I would say that we see the null power issue as being important in order to fully understand how power moves on the grid, and also specifically how the renewable energy credits are managed in the marketplace. So we see value in collecting that information, and I'll end it there. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got 8 million questions now.
Why don't we start with one?
First, let's just start with the transformer one. So every house has a transformer. So if these are emitting carbon, couldn't we just monitor one at one house and know what it's doing rather than tying it back to the facility? And then are you going to replace every transformer that's out there? I mean, the transformers are used in every house there is. I mean, this is ludicrous that you would bring up transformers. I would like to see where you're getting the information, where the technical data is, because I haven't seen this before.
Chair Bailey, Representative, I think all we're saying is simply it's important to collect the information around these emissions. There's not an intent by the department to replace transformers. I mean, we all need power to be fed to our homes and to our businesses and our communities. I certainly understand that. I like to watch a football game from time to time, and I need power to run my TV. So I don't think that's the intent here. We're simply saying, If we're reading the bill the way we are, and it may not be that was the intent of the utilities, they expressed that this bill was more focused on the null power issue, but reading it the way we do, where the count of emissions is limited only to the generating facility, if that's the way to read it, it would preclude counting those emissions from related to the transmission facility. So that's the concern.
Thank you.
Let him follow up. Just follow up, maybe two more.
We have two informational hearings to get to, so we'll want to make it quick.
I just was kind of curious on the Fortune 50 company that you represent, who that is, and then what the benefit, if they would benefit from tighter regulations, that Fortune 50 company.
The Fortune 50 company I represent is General Motors. And yes, they have come out in active support of additional greenhouse gas reduction legislation, including the federal CAFE standards that President Obama promulgated last year. General Motors was in active support of the promulgation of those regulations. Now, does that mean they agree with every regulation that everybody comes up with? No more than you or I would. But they are They are being very, I think, deliberate about trying to reposition themselves as not the company of SUVs, but the company of the Volt and the Spark and the high gas mileage Sonic. And it's very consistent with who General Motors is, that they're also supportive of carbon reductions, but real carbon reductions that are supported by real evidence.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure why I'm on the bill. I'm thinking maybe I was thinking it was relating to greenhouse emissions from canola or something like that. But evidently it was a mistake. So I just want on the record that I support the reporting of carbon and wanting to capture what the use is so that we can have an effective and actual scientific summary of it.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What weight would you suggest we assign to NEL Power when it comes to carbon?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benz, when we have worked through that question, which we had to do because we have to be able to present our customers with a product that they can see the meets and bounds of. So we will look at a null power resource, and we will generally attribute to that or impute to that an average carbon content to the extent that we can identify it that fairly reflects either the utility service territory that it emerges in, or if we can't get that precise, then we'll look at the larger utility, the Western Electric Coordinating Committee sector, or one of the other major sectors that are that are used to manage the electrical system across the country. So we'll try to get it down to the most precise measurement that we can, and then we'll use an average. And so far, both our suppliers and our customers have been happy with that.
Thank you. So the fact that the purchase of the REC at the front end of the generation is mooted by virtue of your approach?
No. The purchase of the REC, in effect, takes the carbon displacement value of that resource and sells it to somebody else. And it's very important that if someone else is claiming it, the utility is not. I think the flaw in the utility argument is an implicit assumption that if they had not bought the output of that qualified facility, even with some carbon content assigned to it, that they would have gone out and purchased a renewable resource, over and above what's required of them by the renewable portfolio standard. And chances are that probably would not have happened. But even if it did, they could take credit for the new renewable resource. They simply shouldn't take credit for carbon reductions from a project where those carbon reductions have been sold to and claimed by somebody else. That's double counting. That's against consumer fraud law.
Just a comment. Finally, the issue of the day is before us, so I appreciate your statement. Yeah. Thank you.
Representative Gilmore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. His question's brought up. And this, maybe Angus, you're the guy to answer this. So if Company A is emitting carbon and Company B is not, Company B can sell a REC to Company A so they can continue to emit while Company B...
Yeah, the whole purpose of that REC market and carbon market, it's a little bit like the sulfuric oxides cap and trade program that was a national program. The idea is to try to find the places where you can reduce carbon the least expensively. And that if that involves transactions between two companies, one of whom can reduce carbon at $10 a ton and the other of whom would have to reduce it at $100 a ton, if the second company can buy carbon reductions from the first company at 15, both companies are better off. So they're better off monetarily, but overall carbon has been reduced. And that's the essential point, essential element of the SOX cap and trade legislation, that SOX emissions from any single plant may continue unabated, but overall SOX emissions get reduced consistent with a declining cap. And those reductions get accomplished at the least overall cost to the system. So what we're particularly interested in with carbon, because carbon has an impact everywhere in the globe, is an overall reduction, not a specific reduction at any given plant. And it's just a less expensive way of getting there.
And for those at home, by SOX, you mean sulfur oxides, ones that get lost in the dryer.
Sorry, yes. Got it. Either one actually would work under a cap and trade regime.
All right.
Ask?
One quick follow-up, then we have to move on.
So, I mean, I'm not trying to put you on the spot anything, but it sounds like then the company that is emitting is really being rewarded for bad behavior while the company that's helping them out continues to do it without emitting, and this one doesn't. I get it, the overall effect is there and the cost is down and stuff, but and that it eventually it evens out, but it just...
Yeah, it is difficult, but we have to sort of divest ourselves of our notions of original sin when we go in to try to figure out how to most cost-effectively reduce an emission like carbon. And as a practical matter, you know, a company in business is not in business to emit carbon. It's in business to produce a product for the market. The carbon emissions are a side consequence. And since we're not out to punish anyone, what we're out to do is reduce carbon, we want to try to find a mechanism that doesn't necessarily find fault with one company or another, but a mechanism that allows both of those companies to benefit and the atmosphere to benefit by an overall reduction of carbon. You know, it's a little aggravating in some circumstances, but it works.
Thank you both very much. Appreciate the testimony.
Sure. Members of the
committee. Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on House Bill 2274? Seeing none, close the public hearing on House Bill 2274. And open an informational meeting. Update from Clean Energy Works Oregon. I'm going to call up Derek Smith.
Good afternoon, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. My name is Derek Smith. I am CEO of Clean Energy Works Oregon. Clean Energy Works is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to create jobs and save energy. We do that through the facilitation of home energy retrofits. What we do is we make it easy for citizens to upgrade their homes for energy efficiency. We connect homeowners with local contractors, local utilities, and local lenders. Here's how the process works. Citizen applies on our website. We send someone out to do an audit of their home to find out where they can get energy savings from their home. We hook them up with a local contractor who we vet for quality and service. That contractor and that homeowner work up a scope of work, a bid is signed, and then we arrange financing for the homeowner from a local lender. And then at the end of the project, we provide 100% quality assurance, and we provide service throughout the project. Currently, we work with 50 different contractors throughout the state, and we have many lending partners, including Umpqua Bank, Selco, Pacific Crest, Federal Credit Union in Lake County, Advantis, and Craft 3. So we also connect homeowners to available public, utility, and private dollars to fund home retrofits. And in doing so, we've helped grow a vibrant marketplace. What we do is we optimize the investment from each of those sources of money. Utilities want energy savings. Private contractors and lenders want a return on their investment. And, of course, the public sector wants job creation and economic development. So we help each of them optimize and leverage each other's investment. We've upgraded 2,700 homes and generated $50 million in economic activity throughout our state, which has meant tremendous revenue for small contracting firms. We've grown the market for whole home energy remodels from 200 homes throughout the state
before we came into existence, to 1,800 homes just in the past year. That's a nine-fold market growth in just 3 years. Clean Energy Works Oregon projects have led to over 1,000 workers receiving paychecks through Clean Energy Works projects. This has meant over 300 workers previously unemployed being hired. We are proud that among those 300, 22 were veterans who now have a job. Through data we have generated since our inception, we know that for every 10 homes that is upgraded for energy efficiency through Clean Energy Works, one job gets created in the hard-hit construction industry. Likewise, citizens save thousands of dollars on energy expenses, and because of the energy savings generated by the 10 homes that we retrofit, three other homes can receive energy without new generation of electricity. We are now upgrading 10 homes every 2 days. And these numbers are all rising as we expand throughout the state. So we're creating opportunities to grow small and medium-sized firms and to hire workers who install insulation, windows, new furnace, new heat pump, and new hot water system. But we're also creating opportunities to grow traded sector jobs. For example, at Umpqua Bank in Roseburg, at Selco Credit Union in Springfield, at Gelblin in Staten, and Indo Windows, a Portland-based startup that manufactures affordable energy-saving window inserts. Indo Windows has credited Clean Energy Works with creating 12 jobs and enabling them to have a test pilot for national expansion of their product made right here in our state. We are in many of your communities. In fact, 82% of Oregon residents can sign up for Clean Energy Works. We've created jobs, helped impact local business growth, and helped your constituents get credit to invest in their largest asset, their home. We're making a dent in the housing economy as appraisers begin to recognize the value of energy efficiency improvements in real estate transactions. And we interact with the state in a variety of ways. We are fulfilling the EAST law, House Bill 2626, 2009, which passed with overwhelming support. I'm going to credit Chair Bailey on that. We've developed a registered apprenticeship program in coordination with Foley and program contractors, workers, training agents, and others. We're working to arrange working capital for contractors as they grow their businesses. That working capital would come from a private lender and be supported by Business Oregon. And we engage local WorkSource agencies in linking job seekers with program contractors who are looking to hire. We are operating in the Rogue Valley, Klamath and Lake Counties, the Central Region, Jefferson, Deschutes, Crook, Lane County, Benton County, the Mid-Willamette Valley, Hood River, and the Columbia Pacific Region and Metro. I want to give you also a forward-looking thought. We're working to include seismic upgrades alongside energy efficiency upgrades, as well as radon mitigation. The contractors are already in the home doing the work. The customer's already having their walls ripped apart. We've already got private lenders who have capital ready to finance these upgrades. So we think it makes perfect sense to do that work as well. And we're just getting started, and this is what I want to close with. Our research shows that there are 600,000 homes in the state that are in need of the services provided by Clean Energy Works. That represents 60,000 jobs and $8 billion in economic development. I appreciate your time and your support, and I'm available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. And I just want to, did I hear you right? You said 2,700 homes, $50 million in economic activity, 300 new jobs. Is that right?
That's correct.
Representative Bitzer.
Thank you. I was wondering if you have any idea how much energy has been conserved through your program.
In total, I do not, excuse me, Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, in total, I do not have the number. But we know that on average, a homeowner is saving 30% on energy annually.
Well, is that 30% of the cost or 30% of the energy consumed?
30%, excuse me, Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, 30% of the energy savings as compared to before the work was done on their home through Clean Energy Works.
So cost, then the answer is
So proportional.
Yep.
Okay. Right.
Thank you. Representative. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. If I had a contractor in my district who wanted to be involved with you, how would, what would they do?
So it is. Chair Boone, Vice Chair Boone, I believe we have that scenario in your district, and what we did is we helped the contractor get certified, meet all the certification requirements, and we helped them get hooked up with whatever resources they needed to buy equipment, to hire workers, et cetera. And we do have contractors in your district working on the program right now.
Is there an opportunity for more to get involved? Or?
Absolutely. As we grow, you know, we will be expanding capacity.
Yep. Who do I send them to?
I'll leave you my card.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Representative Wagner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A lot of the stuff that you guys are doing is good. I'm not sure if you're involved with McMinnville at all. They're a privately owned utility. But they're doing a lot of this, and I'm not sure if you're working it the same way you do it through the, they pay through the energy savings on their bill, where their bill would stay the same, or how are you working it with the customers on their end? But the programs that I've seen out there like this work very well.
Chair Bailey, Representative Widener, we do serve citizens in McMinnville. We work with utilities all throughout the state and work with the Energy Trust of Oregon. To deploy their incentives very efficiently into the marketplace. So we coordinate as best as possible with all utilities that we in whose territories we operate.
And it's correct that you do offer some of that on-bill repayment that he described?
Yes, Chair Bailey. We because of your East legislation, we work with local utilities to through investor-owned utilities to enable on-bill repayment, so that consumers take out a private loan and pay back that loan through the utility bill, which has been a tremendous importance in opening this market. In fact, it's one of the key reasons we've been able to do all this work and create all these jobs.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you talk more about your job creation? I'm a little confused. You talked about, on the one hand, the numbers of, did I hear 60? You heard the big number in terms of thousands of jobs. And on the other hand, I heard for every 10 homes we create, one job is created. So on the one hand, it seems quite little. On the other hand, it seems quite large. How do you factor in the number of jobs actually created via a project or in a... takes X number of projects to create one job, or what's your formula for computing that benefit?
Chair Bailey, Vice Chair Johnson, thank you for the question. Job creation is very important. It's important we communicate this correctly. What I said is that over 1,000 workers have received paychecks through Clean Energy Works work.
Okay.
That may be with subcontractors, that may be with the prime contractor. The 300 new jobs in the construction industry that we have created, we've helped create, are people whose names are next to those jobs. We know who those folks are. Every contractor reports on who was on the job site. We also track work hours by project.
And that 300 jobs is over what time period, roughly?
3 years.
3 years, okay. So what's your business plan or business model going forward from here? Would you call it more of a market-based plan? Is it based on the amount of subsidies that you receive and so forth? Or what's your target going forward? What do you envision?
Chair Bailey, or Vice Chair Johnson, we have a plan to be self-sufficient within 2 years. And the model is built on that we're a service provider connecting the various actors in the marketplace. The homeowner, the lender, the contractor, the utility, and we would monetize the value that we're creating and generate revenue accordingly.
And those subsidies or that revenue that you rely upon now comes from what sources allow you to do what you do?
We have received primarily federal investment to date, and we have received some state investment to support the East bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And how much of that, of those dollars currently goes into the loans that you provide?
The
currently, the incentives from the utilities represent, let's say, this much, and then we add some subsidy to create additional rebates, which gets the homeowner excited to do the project, which creates the job.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and does remind me of all the really hard work you did in getting that bill so it would work. And seeing it here in action is really, really something. I went on your website and I was looking at it. I note that the average is $10,000, and I see the rebates $2,000 and so forth. The component parts of each of the projects would involve an interest rate, and I'm just curious. The bank comes in, makes the loan. How much of your success is driven by the really low rates we now have, if any? And do you anticipate if rates go up, the program will be more difficult to make work? And would that require, because when Chair Bailey and I were looking at this, or when he was showing it to me years ago, that was one of the difficult issues, is how long we would spread it out and what the interest rate would be to make the whole thing work.
Yeah.
And so I'm just curious what points of your current design are interest rate sensitive, and what other parts of it might make it all come to a halt. In other words, what are the weaknesses in the programs, or something we can do to shore it up, or not? Or is it working perfectly and we'll go forever?
Thank you. Thank you for the question. Chair Bailey, Representative Benz. The one of the most important uses of the federal dollars, what the U.S. Department of Energy wanted, was to use federal dollars to create credit enhancements to encourage lenders to lend into this market. They were not lending into this market. In fact, when we started, they weren't really lending anywhere, as you all know. So we used very smartly those public dollars to encourage private lenders to lend into the program. Again, the on-bill tool was the effective market opener. Using that, we've also recruited other lenders. We have a large regional traditional depository institution in Umpqua Bank. We have several credit unions, and we have a community development financial institution who are all competing for the business. And so when you create healthy competition, obviously, rates and terms are set by the market, and ideally they remain competitive and remain attractive to the growing marketplace over time. That's the most important feature we put in place to make sure that rates and terms are attractive to the market. And through the early data that we were able to develop and encouraging those lenders to come into the market, through the on-bill and the East law, we have captured a lot of data which informs lenders about the worthiness of the sector to put private dollars into. And so they are very confident in this market now. They're, as you may know, a lot of lenders are getting shareholder pressure to get cash out and earn a return. We're proud to say this is one of the very few places in the country, if not the only, where credit enhancements are no longer needed to get banks and credit unions to lend into this sector. We're very proud of that.
Well, right. Thank you. And I don't think I heard the answer to my question, which was, if interest rates go up, will this program have difficulty, or are you saying that it's you can, with your data, either extend the term of the repayment in such a way that minimize the impact of rising rates, or what? I'm just curious. We're at an all-time low on rates.
Right.
And so if that changes, will it affect the program?
Okay. Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, I apologize. I was meaning to answer the question through the creation of competition. What citizens want most when they look to upgrade their home for energy efficiency is comfort in their home. They want to know that they're going to get hooked up with a contractor who's going to do quality work. That's what they want the most. So I think we're shielded from, interest rate fluctuations by what the consumer wants most. And then I think we're also shielded by creating that competition. If interest rates go up, the homeowner wants flexible financing options. Some homeowners pay with cash. I don't see a weakness, to be honest, in fluctuations in interest rates. Other weaknesses in the program, I think it's important until the market really stabilizes that that real estate transactions value energy efficiency improvements, so that a customer can think of a home energy remodel like they would a kitchen remodel or a bath remodel, that they'll get a return on that investment, and that utility investment stays in the market as well. I hope that was a reasonable answer to your question.
It is. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks.
Okay, we'll need to move on to our next panel, but thank you very much for coming down.
Thank you all.
Jason Eisdorfer, Margie Harris. Mr. Eisdorfer, thank you for your patience and coming up multiple times for informational hearings. We know you have other work as well, and we appreciate the time that you're spending with this committee as well as you, Ms. Harris. So continuing the theme of where we've come from and where we're going on energy efficiency, we'll continue that with a presentation from the Public Utility Commission, the Energy Trust.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, I'm Jason Eisdorfer, Program Director at the Public Utility Commission. You've heard from me a couple of times already, so I'm going to try to go quickly and let Ms. Harris have a shot at it. There's a lot of pictures in this, so we can sort of go through this relatively quickly. My job is to sort of set the stage and talk about the foundational elements of energy efficiency and the general trajectory in Oregon. The four layers of energy efficiency program, the four pillars, the state, local, state, federal programs, including tax credits, small-scale energy loan programs, low-income weatherization, schools programs, the codes and standards, the residential and commercial energy building energy codes, and federal and state appliance standards. The utility programs, such as the Energy Trust of Oregon and the consumer-owned utility programs through BPA, and then the regional programs that we talked a little bit about 2 days ago, headed up by NEA, Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance, and the Market Transformation. This is a slide from the Northwest Power Planning Conservation Council. This is the region's progress over the last 30 years. It's pretty remarkable. The Northwest really has it right. Oregon, I would argue, has it great. We're a third or more than a third of this accomplishment. These are average megawatts. I think one of the things that I need to attend to for a moment is the issue of the megawatt versus an average megawatt. There was not a lot of discussion on Tuesday about it, and there probably should have been. A megawatt is 1,000 times a kilowatt, and a kilowatt is 1,000 times a watt. A megawatt hour is that chunk of energy, and then an average megawatt is a term used in the Northwest that other folks around the country tend not to use, and that is a megawatt hour for every hour of the year. So that's 8,760 megawatt hours. That is a sizable chunk of energy. For perspective, there are some industrial customers in Oregon that have an annual use of up to 25 average megawatts. There's a couple that go over that threshold. The city of Seattle, on an annual basis, uses 11,000 average megawatts annually. And so here we're looking at something on the order of the over the 30 years, the Northwest has saved four times the city of Seattle's usage.
I'm sorry, but I missed the megawatt averages, megawatt hours per what?
Chair Bailey, Representative, what's it? An average megawatt is 8,760 megawatt hours.
Nice round number.
It's one megawatt hour per hour of the year.
Okay.
How many hours are in the year.
Yeah, okay.
This is a slide put together from information based on the United States Energy Information Administration. I think you can see the colors there. This is indicating the residential usage in Oregon as compared to both California and the national average. And you can see over the last 12 years, Oregon is doing exceedingly well in this regard.
Yep, Mr. Johnson.
Do you have a similar chart that would talk about commercial usage or industrial usage?
Representative Bailey, Chair Bailey, Representative Johnson, I don't, but I can try to find it for you.
Thank you.
This is the levelized cost savings of energy efficiency versus price of power in the market. And the two elements I want to leave you with here are, one, the volatility of market prices up and down. What that big spike you see in 2000 and 2001 is the energy crisis. Energy efficiency not accomplished prior to that point was a lost opportunity, and customers ended up paying for it. So it's it shows both the volatility and extremes of the market and the value, therefore, of the steady state energy efficiency. I think the two points I want to highlight on this slide are connected. One is that there is this constant effort to identify all the cost-effective energy efficiency that is out there. And then really it's the fourth bullet here, is to continue to aggressively pursue acquiring the energy efficiency, looking at new ways to target those opportunities, trying to learn and adapt, a process of continual improvement. I mentioned, I think, last week that over the 30-year history of energy efficiency in this region, that's the common theme, is always trying to get better and find the right mechanism for the right sector. Also, this is a comparison of the fifth plan and the sixth plan of the Northwest Power Planning and Conservation Council's plans. One is 2005 and one 2009. And the real takeaway for this is that between plans, you can see that there is additional savings that has grown into the region. There is an essentially new low-hanging fruit, and that comes from a number of reasons. The two highlights probably are there new innovative technologies, new ways to acquire energy efficiency, and the other is that there are new appliances, new big-screen TVs that are not as energy efficient as they probably should be, and there are savings to be acquired. I have a couple of slides at the very end here to talk about voltage optimization that would fit under the distribution efficiency line, and I'll talk about that in just a moment. These are a couple of pie charts. I think Margie is going to talk a little bit more in depth about them. I just wanted to introduce them to you. I would point out here, this is the commercial sector and the potential within that commercial sector. And I would point out grocery restaurants. I think Margie may talk about this in terms of lighting and refrigeration and the potential opportunities there. I guess a week ago on Tuesday, we came and talked about the energy efficiency purchase power agreement. That would be in the sector in the large office area, so that's up to 14% of those savings. That's where the PUC found the EEPPAs were most suitable. This is an equivalent pie chart for on the gas side. You can see restaurants there also is a significant part of that. And I have, I think, three slides. This is simply the introductory to the voltage optimization. There's a kind of energy efficiency that is within the utility's electric system. This is not something that the Energy Trust does. This is something that the utilities and the Public Utility Commission will be talking to each other about. The one that we were asked to identify there was a voltage optimization at the bottom. And two slides on that. Voltage optimization. The American National Standards Institute voltage range, the acceptable voltage range on the system is 114 to 126 volts. To the degree that you can bring some of that down, you can save and operate on the lower end of that, you can save some energy. If you can bring that voltage down by 2 to 4%, it equals to about 1 to 3% reduction in energy use. This has been something that people have been thinking about for years, but there have been a variety of reasons why it hasn't actually happened. I think that's changing now in Pacific Corp's most recent IRP. The commission in early 2012 added an action item to that IRP to request that PacifiCorp begin some of this high-level screening of a chunk of its distribution circuits to determine whether, through various maintenance and other activities on the distribution side, whether we can begin to capture some of the savings through voltage optimization. And this slide is showing that NEA conducted a pilot using a number of both consumer-owned and investor-owned utilities. And I think finally there is now a recognition of the value of voltage optimization. Again, it's not the biggest chunk of energy efficiency, but it is a sizable enough chunk to start paying attention to. So with that, Chair Bailey, I'm happy to answer questions or turn it over to Margie Harris.
Any questions for Mr. Eisdorfer before we turn over to Ms. Harris? Representative Widener.
Just real quick, let's look at your percent change in residential electrical usage here. So just going through that, how do you factor in basically when we go through unemployment, are people basically, because we got a big drop coming here in 2008, and that's when the economy kind of dropped. I'm just wondering, is that people just probably not turning their heat on because they don't have money to pay their bills, things like that, or are you calculating and factoring those factors into this? And then the commercial side, too, are we actually reducing or are we just losing businesses that aren't using as much power, and that's why that decline is there?
Chair Bailey, Representative Widener, is it this slide or is it a previous slide?
It's actually, they're not numbered. It'd be like the third slide.
This one?
Yeah.
Representative Bailey, Chair Bailey, Representative Widener, it's probably a little bit of both. There, clearly the lines are coming down prior to the recession. Some of the numbers that we looked at on Tuesday indicated that the savings from the Energy Trust in 2010 and 11 were actually quite high. And so that's going to be reflected in that downward trajectory on this slide. So I would say significantly this is related to energy efficiency instead of simply economic effects.
That might be a good segue, Ms. Harrison, to your presentation.
Change. Thank you very much, committee members. I'm Margie Harris, Executive Director of the Energy Trust of Oregon. I appreciate being back here again today. I'll try to keep my remarks very brief. On Tuesday, I provided an overview of Energy Trust activities and our role and our results. And today, I'm going to be talking more broadly about how we work with others, especially our utility partners, to acquire as much energy efficiency as possible. And I welcome your comments or your questions as we go forward. So this slide depicts the amount of electric energy that Energy Trust has saved each year since our programs began in 2002. We just celebrated our 10-year anniversary last year. The numbers are preliminary on the far right column, which is for 2012. But as you can see, we've continually grown this power plant that I referenced the other day to get more and more savings over time.
We're consistently meeting and exceeding.
That's your job. I'm sorry.
You got me going already. As we talked about savings, are you talking about actually measured savings or estimated savings?
These are actual savings with the exception of 2012, which have not been trued up yet. And we determine that through independent third-party verification and evaluation.
Thank you.
So we are meeting and exceeding our targets set by the Public Utility Commission, and we are meeting the requirements of energy efficiency included in the planning done by all the four utilities that we work with. If you were to look at this cumulative growth, we've more than doubled and even tripled our results, and in 2009 we said we were going to do that, and in fact we have realized that. On the gas side, you see a similar story. And again, the far right column is an estimate of our 2012 achievements. But you'll note that the growth here and the pattern is a little bit steeper for gas savings. That's because we have done so much in our region and our state on the electric side for many, many years. And we're starting out on the gas side a little bit later. There's a little lag time. But there's a lot more potential here for gas savings, especially in the residential sector. When we look a little bit deeper in the residential sector, this is a chart of the universe of different energy trust activities. The largest part of the chart, the 5,680 units weatherized in 2011, tells you that those are customers who are taking actions individually. They might upgrade their windows, they might replace their heating system, one-shot deals, one at a time, over a three-year period, usually. You'll see that Clean Energy Works in Oregon and Clean Energy Works Portland, before that, when there was a pilot program, we started to grow that particular segment of the pie by giving people the opportunity to go deeper all at once using financing. And one of the reasons that Clean Energy Works has been successful is that we were able to collaborate and build on the platform the Energy Trust established and work off of our home performance contractors and help take this new tool into the market. When we add in the 2012 numbers, the segment that is for home performance, which is kind of the gold standard around how homes are audited, will get larger because of the activity of Clean Energy Works. We are delivering lasting benefits, and the reason I put the slide in here again is to highlight not only the bill savings, which I mentioned on Tuesday, but to also tell you that there are other non-energy benefits that are very much related to our investments in energy efficiency. And those relate to the environment, and they also relate to the economy. So again, through third-party analysis, we determine how much money is staying in the local economy and in the Oregon economy from the activity that Energy Trust initiates. And you can see we've added $2.1 billion to the Oregon economy in our 10-plus years, $630 million of which is for wages. Many of those companies are small businesses that are decentralized throughout the state, $120 million in small business income, and employment that equals 1,800 jobs that would last for 10 years. We do this because we have a very decentralized approach to how we deliver our services, which relies on small businesses. Some of those are heating contractors. Some of those are working to install new equipment in commercial businesses. Some of them are engineers who understand how large industries work and how to fine-tune industrial processes. So altogether, this investment has added up to not having to pay $1.57 billion and more expensive energy related to fuel, storage, transportation, distribution that the utilities would have had to invest in and that customers would have had to pay for. When we look ahead at where the next kilowatt hour of savings will come from and where the next therm of natural gas will come from, we look at where are we wasting energy still. And primarily that's in the commercial sector and the industrial sector. It's both for small businesses and large businesses, for small industries and large industries. And here, even though we've been working on this in the Northwest for 30-plus years, there are new opportunities created all of the time. And our region has a policy and a framework for investing in energy efficiency as the first preferred resource, our priority resource for meeting future needs. And it's the Energy Trust's responsibility to deliver and meet those needs on behalf of utility customers. I'm a person who gets bored easily. I like change. And this industry has captivated my interest since the 70s. And it's because it's always reinventing itself and it's always discovering new ways to innovate. The next opportunities are determined largely through a number of inputs. You can think of these inputs as ingredients. We use program evaluation as a primary source of how well did we do at achieving our goals at the price that we thought, how much did we save, was it as much as we predicted it would be, what do customers experience, what feedback can we glean from them, how deeply have we penetrated a key market, what new technologies are out there for us to pilot and test in our climate? How are we doing at achieving the potential that was identified in the utility integrated resource plans? How deeply are we going into targeted markets where those are identified, such as small commercial buildings? All of this is funneled through and comes out the other end as a program strategy and a program design that we develop publicly with a lot of the people who deliver the services with us. That whole system is pretty well greased and operating quite effectively after a decade. A lot of what we do is directly in cooperation and collaboration with the individual utilities who are submitting their plans to the Public Utility Commission about where their next increment of energy will be purchased, and energy efficiency is in the first order, the priority resource. We work directly with the utilities to identify targets to meet their goals of energy efficiency as part of their integrated resource plans. That, in turn, drives the Energy Trust goals and helps us set our budget, and the budget is determined ultimately through the Public Utility Commission and their approval of tariff filings from the utilities. So that sets our roadmap, and we are out there planning and updating those scenarios with the utilities every 2 years and looking out 20 years at a time to capture the potential for energy efficiency. These two slides are from...
I just had a question.
Yes, please.
On what do you mean by tariff filings?
Okay. Thank you, Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt. A tariff filing is a rate filing submitted by a utility to the Public Utility Commission for their consideration. It's a public process that would increase or decrease the rates charged by utilities to their customers. That's one nutshell definition. Do you want to add to that? Since
How did you use it? You were talking pretty fast.
I know, I'm sorry.
How did you use it in that sentence?
That when we develop a goal for the utility to meet their energy efficiency requirements in their integrated resource plans, there is a cost associated with the acquisition of that energy, just like there's a cost associated with all energy that's acquired. And that is a part of a tariff filing that is included when the utilities go forward to the Public Utility Commission for a rate change.
Okay. Thank you.
Is that clear? Thank you very much.
Sort of.
Just a few more slides. Electric energy savings are going up. The potential is going up. And where we expect to be in the out years around 2016 is a need to fill the gap between the green line and the blue line. So the green line represents where is that potential taking us? What new technologies will come on board? What new strategies and techniques will we apply? So we are actually looking that far ahead to fill the pipeline with new opportunities and ensure that we have the mechanisms to deliver those savings. Same on the gas side, only we're tracking even closer. Again, this is a steeper growth curve. And most of the opportunity on the gas side is in the residential sector, whereas most of the opportunity on the electric side is more distributed. We've done such a good job on the electric side for residential. This is a small sampling of some of our current initiatives and to give you a flavor for where we make our investments for the future. So emerging technology. We are very interested in the new technology that the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance and us worked on for heating water. It's a heat pump water heater. It's a highly efficient unit. We test it in a small scale way. We gather data. We make sure it operates well in our climate, and we take that program to scale. And Energy Trust's role is putting an incentive on it and educating people about its availability. Light-emitting diode lighting, both interior and outdoor lighting, is another example. Focusing on data centers, which use tremendous amounts of energy, is another target area for us. Strategic energy management, just to highlight a couple of these and then I'll move on, is for those customers who want to manage their energy use through operations and maintenance improvements. They lack capital or they don't want to spend their precious capital this way, and we're seeing 12 to 15% declines in their energy use just by managing the resource on site better. Automated controls would be an example of that. And sharing best practices across cohorts of people enrolled in these programs with us over a 9-month period is a way that we build people's understanding of how to manage their energy use in their facilities better. Bulk purchases, I'll just highlight that. This is more of a community-oriented approach, looking upstream like we did in purchasing bulk solar, but applying that same principle to commercial buildings who all need rooftop units or economizers. How can we work with the suppliers to reduce the cost of those and have them on hand? How could we even attract manufacturers to the state so they would provide the equipment that we want to install and have it be very available? So things of this nature represent our innovation and our creativity and our cooperation with many other market actors to make sure that we're on the cutting edge and that we're going to look ahead in the future to make sure we are prepared. More examples here, including behavior approaches. Very important to have people modify their behavior using a handheld device on their way home to activate their heating system and manage their heating system or their lights. Sending them information in the mail about how much they're using compared to their neighbors is another technique that's called O-Power. So these are just brief examples of how we're working with many people in the marketplace to deliver the services. So I thank you very much. I, again, would like to be a resource to you if that's helpful, and I wish you all a happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you. Further questions? Okay. Thank you both very much for the presentation. Appreciate it. Thank you, committee members, for your attention. We will close the informational hearing, and committee is adjourned.